Hello, listeners. Welcome to another episode of Reckless Talk, our TTRPG interview show where we sit down with some of our favorite writers, players, GMs, and streamers to get to know a little bit more about what makes them who they are. I am, as always, your host, GM Nathan. I use he, him pronouns. And this week, I got to expand my mind and laugh a lot with renowned game designer Spencer Campbell of Gila RPGs. That name is possibly familiar to longtime Reckless Talk listeners, as he and his games have been listed as huge inspirations for several of our guests. Spencer is a design whirlwind and has put out several really diverse, unique, and award-winning games over the last few years. That includes the punchy Lumen system and creator kit, Hunt, a game about a doomed knightly order going on a final quest, the monster hunting game Slayers, and the solo Souls-like game Reap. Seriously, that's just like a portion of what he's written, and so many of them take really novel approaches with what is fun about games. Sometimes there's no dice, no health, loot pools, approaches instead of skills, all kinds of really good stuff that we get to talk about in this episode. Plus, we talk a lot about the importance of connection in the TTRPG space, trying to protect your sanity online, his background in cognitive psychology, and as usual, tons more. As of this episode, his latest game, Loot, all about fantastical item gathering, combat, exploration, and base building, is crowdfunding. I am super excited to see that full release, which we get into during this chat. Links to that and everything we talked about are in the show notes, as always. If you enjoy this episode, please go check out some of our other Reckless Talk interviews and maybe even some of our actual play episodes while you're there. With that, I'll see you next time. Enjoy. Hello, Spencer.
Hello.
It is so lovely to see, hear, and talk to you today. How are you?
I'm doing very well. I'm excited to be here. Happy to chat with you.
Excellent. Yes, I am unbelievably excited. It was definitely one of those, not to immediately, you know, start like just being overexcited and gushing, but it was one of those interviews. I say this with most interviews, but one of those where it's like, man, Spencer's done a lot of stuff. Spencer's talked about a lot of stuff. All of it is very interesting and good. Really hope that I cover enough of it to be sort of interesting and encapsulate all of it. It was a very intimidating, but in a kind of exciting way, preparing for this interview. So I'm glad the day is finally here and I can stop worrying if I have read enough articles or SRDs or whatever.
I am sure you are more than equipped. I feel like I've got a lot that I need to be ready to talk about, which I think, you know, I'm trained enough to be able to go off the cuff. I'm ready for a good conversation.
As am I. As we've said already, you know, you've designed a lot of games, you've designed different systems, SRDs, written a lot of fiction. You have hosted a couple of shows, all of which I'm sure that we'll get into in-depth conversations about as we go. But here on Reckless Talk, that's not where we start the conversation. No, we start at the beginning, at the, sure. the Nexus event. Is that a thing? Or am I thinking of like Star Trek Generations? I'm not sure.
Sounds right.
we'll both, as long as you and I agree, we will ignore all listeners who may be correcting us in their heads as they're listening to this in a few weeks' time. But the point is we start at the core of your, we'll just say nerdery, whatever that means. So where did not just your kind of exposure or introduction to tabletop role-playing games, like as a concept and activity, where did that begin? But also, if it's more appropriate, when did your journey into the world of nerddom and such niche interests begin for you?
I'm a very late bloomer when it comes to role-playing games. So for me, it was very much a journey of being in the nerd space in its many forms before getting to role-playing games. I had a Nintendo, like an NES when I was a kid. So like introduced to video games very, very early on. I also have a very distinct memory of when Pokemon first arrived in the United States because I was like nine or 10 years old. And I swear to God this happened. Although, like, every part of me questions whether or not this really happened. Is they sent VHS tapes of the first episode of Pokemon to some houses in the United States before Pokemon actually emerged to, like, seed excitement. And one of these tapes arrived at our house. And I remember watching this with my brother and having no idea what the hell we were watching. Like, no concept of what this is. And then, like, months later, Pokemon suddenly is everywhere. Like, it's in, like, it has taken over our elementary school, and, like, everybody's talking about it and playing the game. And so, like, I swear, I feel like I'm crazy every time I tell this story because it sounds absurd, but I swear, like, that's kind of my first entry into, like, nerdery is we got a secret cassette tape or VHS tape sent to our house to get early access to Pokemon to, like, get all those American kids amped up ready for this show. And so that's, like, my real weird origin story.
Yeah, I have never heard that before. And I don't want to add on to your paranoia of, oh no, maybe I'm making this up, but that is that sounds
it sounds unbelievable, sounds right?
Untrue. Yeah. But in the point of, like, well, why would Spencer make that up? So I will believe you, but that's nonsense.
Yeah, it is. It truly is nonsense. So I would say, like, my first foray into, like, nerdy games and stuff like that would be in high school. We started getting into tabletop war games. So I played, like, 40K and Games Workshop's Lord of the Rings strategy game that came out, like, along with the movies when they were coming out 20 years ago, and, like, HeroClix, and we played a lot of that stuff. I had always been somebody who tinkered with making rules and stuff like that since I was, like, 5 years old.
Yeah.
So we started doing our own campaigns and our own characters, like, you know, role-playing-esque, but at a scale of, like, wargaming, which is kind of, like, what the history of tabletop role-playing games is anyway.
Yeah, sure.
So, like, we did that little microcosm on our own growing up in the Chicago suburbs. It wasn't until grad school for me that I was really introduced to role-playing games proper.
Yeah.
And even then, my origin story into role-playing games exposure is weird. Because prior to that, I, in high school and all through college, was a massive StarCraft fan. Professional StarCraft.
Yep, sure.
So, like, I would stay up until, like, 4 o'clock in the morning to watch the Koreans play.
Been there.
It was, like, the best. And in professional StarCraft, you are either Korean or you're a foreigner. Everybody else is foreigners if you're not a Korean. And so my favorite foreigner player, one of my favorite foreigner players, was Jeff Robinson, who played under the name In Control.
Mm-hmm.
And In Control was on one of the very earliest actual play role-playing streams, the one that was just called Role Play. And I didn't know anything really about Dungeons and Dragons, but I knew Jeff Robinson.
Yep.
I was like, I'll watch Jeff play whatever this game is that he's doing. And I was, you know, I was aware of what D&D was, but literally I didn't know anybody growing up who played this. And I was around the nerdiest nerds, like, throughout all of school.
The Warhammer nerds. Yeah.
Yeah. So, like, I should have been exposed to it, but apparently it just, like, it hadn't broken into our space. And so it really wasn't until grad school where I, like, saw D&D being played. And I was like, oh, okay, this seems really cool. I'm into this. And then from there, I started playing role-playing games. And I started as a GM, and I've always been the forever GM. I, like, never get to play games. But you know, my first games that I ran were Powered by the Apocalypse games. I didn't play D&D until much, much later, and
really?
Didn't play it for very long because we didn't like it. but we started off with Dungeon World, and then I actually made, like, a Star Wars hack of, like, PBTA games, like, right out the gate.
Like, so, like, immediately you're like, I'll just make my own game.
I'm
no
just
problem.
Gonna start making it. Yeah, exactly. Because I had two different groups of people who wanted to play, and one of them was full of Star Wars nerds, but they weren't really into fantasy, and then the other were super into the idea of fantasy. And so I was like, well, I'll use the one existing game, and then I guess I'll have to just kind of repaint this other game to be Star Wars-y. And that's my origin story into, like, the various stages of nerdery, and then eventually into, like, role-playing games.
So already much to unpack.
Yeah, it's weird.
and I won't talk at all about professional StarCraft stuff, even though I could just turn this into an hour long conversation.
I'm ready to go.
You know, 2010s era, you know, professional video gamers. But I won't. That's another podcast. Instead, I guess I'll ask first, just you're watching someone play Dungeons and Dragons / tabletop role playing games for the first time. And there is that click in your head of not just, oh, that's what this is, but also, oh, that's, well, now that's interesting. Something about this calls to me. So for you, grad school, you sitting down watching this thing, what was it that started kind of getting your interest and drawing you in to become the now like decade plus of doing to some amount of tabletop stuff that you've been doing?
It was like watching the GM do their thing, like watching specifically the GM had create a world and like then creating these scenarios for people to be playing in, like that in my head just immediately jumped out. It's like, that's cool. I want to do that. Cause I was creating scenarios and things like that for our war games. And so being able to take that concept of, instead of just like, this is a battle we're going to do, but now it's, here's a story we're going to play out and here's a world. Like I was, you know, I read Lord of the Rings growing up. I loved world building. I read the Silmarillion because you have to read the Silmarillion to if you're a lore junkie. And so I was like, okay, give me the world. And so seeing somebody having made a world that other people were playing in was immediately intriguing to me.
And was it making your own world too? Like, was there ever any kind of like, oh, I'd love to run around in Middle Earth and play the Lord of the Rings role-playing game, or you played in Star Wars? Like, was there a particular appeal to running around in an existing world, or was it pretty much from the get-go like, oh, now I get to do my thing and I get to make my own?
Very much the latter there, because it was like I had been already making stuff or like playing things in other worlds. And so suddenly watching somebody having had made this thing whole cloth and like that made me go like, oh, that's a lot of cool, flexible freedom that you get to do in making that. And, you know, I have always been an obsessive daydreamer. And so like to be able to take daydreams about worlds that are just inside my head and suddenly bring them to a table felt like the coolest thing that you could possibly do.
Again, you said like four sentences in your origin story. The next follow-up question that I immediately have, you started playing Powered by the Apocalypse. Mm. That is not usually the kind of de facto pipeline of, oh, I saw someone play Dungeons and Dragons and now I'm going to go play Dungeons and Dragons, right? That's like, that's just kind of right. One-to-one how it works for a lot of people. How did that, you just immediately are like, ah, let me do the indie version of this. So how did that kind of come in as an option and what you guys ended up going with?
So there's kind of like two points there. One is having watched the D&D stream, it was entertaining, but also I found it, and even watching the players get very frustrated with the mechanics. Mm. There's like a clear memory I have in my head of Jeff's character wanted to basically like take out somebody who was unconscious in front of them and just like, okay, I'm just going to finish them off. And the GM said, roll. And I was like, are you kidding me? Like this why are we doing this? And like, Jeff was also like, why am I doing this? And then rolled and missed. And suddenly we're like, okay, we're now in a scenario where we have to somehow describe why you were unable to hit this unconscious goblin boss in front of you or whoever it was. And like, I watched that in a number of instances in this D&D campaign where there was a lot of like GM fiat and like just friction between like what the GM wanted and what the players wanted. That was a huge turnoff. So while the concept of role playing was really interesting to me, how it was being presented, at least in this D&D like 3.5 context, I was like, yeah, that can't be the thing that we do. And so like alongside this like early stream, like more breakoff streams emerged. And that's where I got exposed to a lot of the indie designers that were big at the time or who were doing a lot of GMing. And so I had seen some examples of play using Powered by the Apocalypse games. And I went, oh, okay, that seems much more in line with what I'm interested in doing, or at least they all seem to be having a good time playing this game.
Yeah.
And so bringing that to the table, and then also understanding the audience, or not the audience, but the table that I was going to be playing with.
Sure.
I was playing with Chicago improvisers who are top tier comedians who don't want a script, and they don't want to play by really hard and fast rules. They want to play through yes anding and through interpretation and narrative thought and collaborative storytelling. And so having seen PBTA games in action, I realized that that fit perfectly with the group that I was going to first try playing these games with. And so it's the sort of combination of all those things that like ultimately brought me to say, yeah, I'm going to bring this to the table instead of D&D, which is what everybody else had been doing.
Yeah, that makes sense. So were you also someone who has done like improv and that kind of stuff? Or are they just a group of people that you knew that who all happened to be improvisers?
I'm not an improviser at all. My brother is. So he's a comedian trained at Second City. And so he lived with a bunch of improvisers, and I ended up living with them for a period of time. So his friends became my friends. And so I just knew a bunch of improvisers. Yeah. I myself wasn't one, which actually kind of made it very fun because I didn't really have to do tons and tons of prep. I could do a little bit of prep and then just kind of watch and see what they would do. Or I wouldn't even need to know the answers to some of like the puzzles or problems, because I would just put it in front of them and just watch them work. And it would be amazing to watch. And so while I wasn't an improviser, I was by like osmosis, by being around people who do bits 24/7, like you just learn how to how to keep up with them.
Yep, you gotta learn how to hang, or else you're just left in the dust. Yes, totally makes sense. So you have now been introduced. You get it. You're already exploring, not just exploring different systems, but you're already exploring the idea of what you want out of this experience and what works for your players. At what point do you start saying like, well, wait a second, I'm running games, I'm making my game, my campaign, people are making games. What if I also started making games and putting things together? You already started with your, you know, kind of homebrewing your Star Wars version.
Right.
But, you know, kind of when did that become not just something that you did again, kind of for one off thing, but that you were really interested in and driven to do, let alone release publicly and do out loud, I guess.
Right. So one of the people that I met in these early days was Mike Riemann, who folks who know my games, Mike is the person who does a lot of the art or the layout or the covers for tons and tons of my stuff. So we bonded very quickly over our love of games, and we were both huge board game people too. So we both decided, let's try making board games together. So we had spent years doing attempts at board game design and card game design. And that is a very difficult process, especially if you've never done anything like that before.
Yes.
Just because there's like so much more involved in making a board game, like just from like building a prototype, like you can just put words on a page and role play like that. You don't even need dice. You can have a dice roller on your phone, but like you need stuff in order to test a board game. And so we did it for a while, but like nothing ever emerged from it because it was just so difficult. But around that time, then I was starting to dip into just like trying to make my own role-playing game. And I was working on my own system, like trying to make my own unique system instead of making a hack. And basically two things happened at the same time. One, the first zine quest ever got announced. And so it was like, oh, here's an opportunity. It's a very focused thing. You're not making a giant book. You're just making something that's like 32 pages. And like at the time, zine quest was supposed to be like all black and white in the interior and everything. Like that was like the rules. And nowadays, like nobody follows the rules of zine quest, and it kind of, you just do whatever you want. But like, it was just like, oh, this is a perfect point of entry. I don't need a lot of fancy like art. It doesn't need to be super colorful, and it doesn't need to be big. It can be simple. So that got announced, and then COVID happened. And these things basically all started happening around the same time. And so I said, okay, if I'm stuck here doing nothing at home, why not take the shot at trying to do this? And so that's when it all started to kind of tumble into, okay, well, I'll do my first zine quest, and then I'll start building new games and see what happens from there.
So what was the zine quest game?
It was Score, which is my heisting game, which was actually nominated for an Emmy for Best Rules, which was like a really wild experience.
That is very wild.
Yeah. So to have my very first game get released and then as a zine get nominated for Best Rules as an Emmy for an Emmy, it didn't win, but it got nominated. It was like, oh, OK, maybe I'm kind of good at this. maybe there is something here. And awards are a whole thing, and there are a lot of good things and bad things about awards. But at the time, it was the like boost that I needed to go like, okay, I made a thing. It was good. People seem to like it. Now I feel like I've got that energy to kind of make more stuff.
Yeah, definitely. So I think it's just a good time to start into your process of how you start chipping away at games. I'm sure this process has probably changed over the years that you've been doing it. Sure. So I leave full freedom with you to answer this question as you will. But where do you start? Kind of specifically, like, are you someone who is going after a vibe, you know, a genre? Are you going after some, you know, some specific, like, here's the kind of story that I want to tell? Or are you someone who's like, I have an idea for this mechanic, and now let's build a world and a game and stuff around it? Is it somewhere in between? Where does that first kernel come for you?
It's probably somewhere in between, but I think at the beginning, I was very much mechanics first. I was, here's an idea of an interesting way to roll dice or resolve conflict or things like that. And then what can be done to make a whole game out of that? Like Slayers was very much me thinking about a variety of different mechanics and then figuring out how to glue them all together. But then like I started to switch into, okay, well, what are the types of games that I want to be playing in the first place? And this is when I started to move towards what would ultimately become the Lumen system, because I grew up with video games. And so like video games are a very important part of my life. I play them all the time. And so I wanted to be able to bring that concept, the vibe of the types of video games that I like to play, which are action games, action RPGs, looter shooters, things like that, and bring them to the table. So then that was more, this is the concept. How do I mechanize this in a way that is satisfying to me and like captures the essence of what these games are about in a way that I would want to play it and that other people might want to play it as well? And so that's where like Light came from, and then what would eventually become the Lumen system and Nova and the stuff that followed it.
Do you remember what the turning point was for you, kind of in those different perspectives, other than, again, like I created an idea like Lumen?
Right.
That's such an interesting shift, especially kind of already seemingly coming from a place that was very like, well, those mechanics for Dungeons and Dragons don't seem very nice. Mm-hmm. I think I'm going to do these other different mechanics. That sounds like a better game. You know, is there a moment or kind of a process that you went through where you noticed that kind of, I won't say priority shift, but starting point shift?
I remember I had been doing design for a little bit, and I was describing these campaigns that I was playing to my cousin who I play video games with. We grew up together, play video games together. We played Destiny since the alpha came out. Like we played all these games together, and I was describing them to him, and I was like, you would like this. And he didn't want to try it. And so I was like, well, what if I made a game that was like Destiny? And that was sort of the shift then. It was like, okay, can I take this thing that we enjoy from a different media here, like a different way of play, and bring it to this other thing that I've been really enjoying with tabletop role-playing games? And so that sort of was, I think, the shift of going, okay, I think there's something to this idea of translating things that I love to the tabletop, as opposed to here's a rule that I think is good. What would this fit into?
Yeah, that totally makes sense. So no matter what angle you're starting at, I guess, rules-wise, vibes-wise, et cetera, how do you distinguish, or is there a distinguishing point between this is an idea I like and this is a game, if that makes sense? Where it's like, as you're kind of ruminating on like, well, what if I made a Destiny? Or what if I made, again, a looter shooter? I know I personally have gotten kind of lost in the genre sauce before and been like, well, this is a cool genre, cool story. And then how do I make a game out of it?
Yeah.
Is that something that you run into, or is it something that you're just able to be like, well, I like this vibe, and so now I'm just going to keep at it until I find a game?
I run into that all the time. Like, there are so many projects that I am designing that eventually just don't make it past, like, just core premise.
Yeah.
Where I have, like, this is the idea of the game. I think it's a cool idea for the game. Do I have the fuel in me right now to do that? Maybe, maybe not. Also, how many other things am I working on at this time? And like, I can be very sporadic with this, where like some of my games are written in these insanely fast bursts, like 48 hours. The game is written. It's done. It's there. Like Corvid Court, I wrote in a weekend because I just got obsessed with this idea of birds doing crime. And I was like, yeah, okay.
I mean,
done.
As far as core premises go, that's a solid core premise to chase down. So makes sense.
Yeah. And so that was easy. But then there are others that feel like such solid premises to me, but I can't find the mechanics in my head that work the way that I want. Or what I find nowadays is the thing that stops me from working on something or finishing something is I imagine a potential future as opposed to just like making it happen. And what I mean by that is I go, what does this game look like in a year? How can I support this game further? Or like, what if I held onto this mechanic for another game that's a more perfect fit for this thing than this? And so like, I sometimes stop myself from working on something because I have this desire for it to be like exactly right and perfect. And yeah. That's a fool's errand to do that because you just simply will never get anything done at that point. And there are plenty of times where I'm able to like ignore that voice in my head. And then there's others where I go, well, this game's just never going to get off the Google Doc because I have not found a way where I will feel satisfied 1 year later saying, yes, that's the version of the game that I wanted to put out. And I have no notes or changes to it. I also think it's really important and cool when people iterate and remaster their own games. And so like, I don't give myself that like leeway to be like, just release it. And then if you want to change it in a year, change it. It's a weird back and forth that I battle with.
Is that a hard process to just put an end to it and say, all right, I'm leaving this one again, leaving this one in the Google Drive, and I will not, maybe I'll look at it again one day. Maybe I won't. Maybe it is dead to me forever and I'm deleting it. What's your, I guess, relationship, if any, with, I guess, game design failure? Mm. How do you navigate times where it just doesn't work, either a mechanic, either an idea, or a release that doesn't go the way you want? Yeah. Just kind of what's your relationship with failure generally?
Like some things, it's really easy to let go. Like some things, I get the idea in my head and I get the premise on the page and I go, this either immediately doesn't feel good to me or I don't feel excited about it and I'm okay shelving it. I was actually just talking with my friend Will Yopst about this morning because we do like a bi-weekly just hangout chat.
Oh, lovely.
And we both have this thing where we're like, oh yeah, I can just like think about it for 30 minutes and be satisfied knowing that it will never exist because it's not enough. Mm-hmm. And then there are others that are like impossible to fully let go where you're like, no. I'll figure this out. I promise you I will figure this out, even if it takes me years and coming back to it every 3 months or so. And I look at it and I go, OK, here's what I would do this time. Will most of them make it across the finish line? No, probably not. But I think there's something valuable in having those projects that don't make it to just have them on the page so that you've thought about the idea, like at least engaging with the idea to a certain degree so that you can feel somewhat satisfied in knowing like, OK, I thought about it. I wrote some words down and like the words didn't feel good. And so now, even though I think the concept is good, my like first attempt at it just felt bad. And I'm actually okay then saying goodbye to that, or at least I'll see you in 6 months and see how I'm feeling after that.
And now a word from our sponsor.
This episode is brought to you by Tumblestrom's Tome of Unicorns. This new book by Lucas Anderson offers 10 brand new unicorns and unicorn-themed stat blocks for 5th edition, including the Goopy Oozicorn, the Primeval Unicorn, and the Unicorn of Majesty. Each is accompanied with lore and plot hooks to inspire GMs using them for their campaign. There's also a section of unique magic items like the Bow of Fecundity. That's fun to say. Plus, all that is set to super evocative rock and roll zine art. Tumblestrom's Tome of Unicorns is a very flavorful and easy-to-use supplement and can be found right now on the Dungeon Masters Guild. That's TUMBLESTRUM'S, Tome of Unicorns. Available now on the Dungeon Masters Guild.
Hello, this is your pilot speaking. I would like to welcome you to Reckless Airlines. Our total flight time for this episode is approximately 1 hour, and we will be cruising at an altitude of 2,000 frog stacks. In a little bit, the flight attendants will be by with complimentary clips and excerpts from previous Reckless Attack episodes. We know you have a lot of choices when it comes to 5th edition Dungeons & Dragons actual play podcasts, and we would like to thank you for choosing ours. If you enjoyed your experience during today's episode, please be sure to fill out the in-flight survey and leave us a rating or review, or tell a friend. Book your next flight with us at www.recklessattack.com, and thank you for listening.
Something that I am always really interested in for creators, especially ones who are doing it either by themselves or with a very small team, is making things takes a lot of weird different skill sets. Marketing and game design and fiction writing and like balancing and project management and working with artists or freelancers and like audio editing, like whatever it is. For game designing itself, for this just sheer making of a game and putting words on paper, and also maybe just more holistically in the space of putting games out into the world and getting people to buy them.
Sure.
What's the easy part for you? You know, what's the part where it's like, as long as I have the energy for it, I will do that indefinitely. What's the juicy part for you?
I mean, the easiest part is writing core premises and vibes and lore. I love writing lore and fiction, even if like a lot of it doesn't go into the book itself, just because I think it's very fun for me to imagine what the world of a game looks like. I could do that stuff all day long. And like core premises or just like mechanical structures. So not the actual words that will go into the rule book itself, but the like, here's mechanically what this will sort of feel like. And what needs to be done in order to make that happen, I can do that all day long. Have a blast doing that sort of stuff. Turning that into like the actual words that go in the rule book is much harder for me. I love a document full of bullet points that the game is there. In my head, the game is there in those bullet points. But then translating that into the text is, I won't say that's the hardest, because that's definitely not the hardest part. But that is more of a challenge than like, I can write bullet points of things all day long and be so, so happy.
Yeah, right. If only you could just release bullet points with cool art next to it and be like, behold, a game.
Figure it out. I talked with Will about this too, of like, what if we just like, because I feel like if I could just like go on a walk and audio record the game, just like, here's me talking for an hour about what I think this game is.
Yeah.
And then just put that on itch and be like, here's the game. It's in this audio. You have to listen to it. And like these weird notes that I put down, I'm not going to put it into layout. I'm not going to put full sentences together other than the audio recording. And it's not going to be in any kind of order that's helpful to you. But the game is there and you can put it together.
And for some people's brains, like that is an optimal learning experience.
Yeah.
So I'm just like, I want to hear someone just talk at me about the vibes, and then I'll pick up those vibes and be like, cool, I got enough of it. We're playing this game.
Exactly.
We got it. So, you know, I won't say there's a large, robust market for it, but someone would be delighted by that format. I am very convinced of it.
Yeah.
I guess on the other hand, then what's the hard part? This can be an either and both kind of answer. But when it comes to going from idea to thing that is out and consumable.
Yeah.
What are the stuff that is like, man, this is a slog. I know it's an important part of the process, and I gotta do it. And it never gets easy to decide on the mechanic or decide on what the cover looks like or blah, 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 blah.
Yeah. I mean, the hardest thing is marketing.
Yeah.
Because I've gotten to the point where I have like a core group of people that I can count on as like a team to help put the game together. Like Will Yopst is going to edit the game and Mike will probably do the layout and Galen Peugeot will probably do the art. And like, I can count on those people to handle the things that I have no skills in doing, but because I've worked with them so much, like that's never a headache. Figuring out graphic design and art and editing and stuff like that, just because I've got those relationships. So the hardest part then is, okay, the thing is put together, let's release it. And there's a lot that is frustrating about that process. Even something as simple as making an itch page is very annoying to me. I do not like making a page on itch to release the game because like, good-looking pages will sell more, yep. And I don't want to put any effort into it. I just want to put the PDF there, and you can buy the PDF, but like you have to put some effort into it, and you have to think about what copy goes into that to compel people. That alone is annoying, but then there's like, okay, I made the page. It's up on itch. People can buy it. Now I've got to like get people to go buy it, and the marketing part is the hardest part because there's some things that work really, really well. Crowdfunding obviously puts eyes in front of things, but not every single project you make can be crowdfunded. That's like a really difficult task unless you aren't. I mean, I should say every game that I make doesn't, because I write at an absurd rate. It's unhealthy how frequently I release things.
That is one of the many reasons that this was like a lightly intimidating interview, because it's like, all right, usually, you know, max it's like three or five games is like, oh holy shit, I have so much to pull from, I hope I can incorporate everything. And like looking at your itch page, it's like between like robust supplements and full games and SRDs and all this, like there's like 15 things on that page, and each of them are like their own deal.
there's too much that goes into some of these things, and so like it's a lot to manage the release and marketing of one big thing after another, and just trying to figure out like, okay, how do I space these things out so that I'm not like stepping on my own toes? Cause like I've got Loot coming out on Kickstarter next week. And then I've got another game that's text complete. Like I just want the art to start getting put together so that I could release it, but it would be foolish of me to do that. So it's like figuring out, okay, when do we manage this? When do we plan to do this? And then how do I get the hype drums going on that? Because it's been exhausting trying to get the hype drums going for Loot. And you got to do it again and again and again. And like some games, they sell themselves and they don't require a lot of effort. And then other games, most games don't. And you have to put in so much work and so much thought into figuring out, how am I going to convince people that they should separate some of their hard-earned money for this thing.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard. It's real hard.
Yes. Yeah, indeed it is. And I'm sure we'll get into that a little bit more, but you know, we're still early in the interview. So let's focus on the nice parts for a little bit longer, as long as we can. One thing that you already mentioned, and something that was super, super clear to me as someone who's read a good amount of your games, has watched some actual plays of all your games, is the amount of kind of world that is a part of all of your games. Mm. There's a clear genre or clear premise or clear fantasy, lowercase f fantasy that is being kind of captured here. And then there's world details and just little snippets. Is that something that you feel is like important, not just in kind of a game, like something to exist, but also a part of your process, that you have kind of a good hold on the fiction and the world that this is being set in? Or is it just like a fun thing that you do for yourself as a fun little treat to get in the game?
It's definitely a fun treat for myself, just because I love lore. Like I'm the kind of person who just watches like hour long lore videos about things that I like. Just that's the media that I consume when I'm not working on games. So like being able to do that, like some degree of world building and lore creation, is like just, it's perfect for me. It's what I really enjoy doing. But I do think it's important for the games that I make too, just because I find the games that I'm most easily able to run that aren't my own games are the games that have like a very clear sense of what they are and where they are, as opposed to here's this generic sci-fi thing. You can put it in any setting and yeah, it works every in all things. And like that stuff is cool. It has its place. But for me, even if I'm not going to use most of your world, I want some things that I can hold on to. Nobody plays a world written, or I don't know, maybe some people do, but I don't. I like to take some of the ideas and then change it. Like, it's the reason why I think Spire is one of my favorite games, is that like the mechanics are fine. I changed the mechanics when I made Corvid Court, which is a resistance game, because I wanted to speed up the whole process. But the coolest thing about Spire is the world that it takes place in. It is the coolest world. And so to me, that is the thing that drew me into wanting to buy that game and then run that game in our own weird version of this mile high nightmare city with dark elf political revolutionaries.
Very flavorful, very distinctly flavorful.
So like, you know, that stuff, like having worlds is a big thing for me when I'm deciding as a person to buy a game. And so like for me, then it's a really important part of designing games as well. It's just knowing like, okay, whoever's going to be picking this up, like, let me give them some hooks to work with.
Something that you just mentioned, and that I know you do a good amount of, just based off kind of what I have seen of you through blogging, through social media posts, et cetera, is reading and consuming other games, whether or not you're running them or just kind of like putting them into your brain and letting them percolate. Is that something that you do a good amount of? Is that something that you enjoy doing, or something that you like try to be intentional in consuming just to kind of keep your brain fresh? Or what's your relationship with other people's stuff?
I'm actually very choosy about what I decide to read. And there's a few reasons for that. One is there's just too many games. We all have our giant shelf of shame of all the things that we haven't played and probably haven't even read. And so like some of it is there's just not enough time to do it. The other thing is I spend a great amount of my time like with my job reading. It's reading homework assignments and things like that my students write in papers. But like I do a lot of reading anyway that I... When I decide I'm going to read something, it needs to be something that I've really decided I want to read.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, if I'm in terms of like non-RPG books, I listen to audiobooks instead, because my brain just doesn't want to scan text on a page.
Yep.
If it's so associated with my job. That's also why I listen to those like lore videos, because I don't need to read anything and I can just have someone tell me something.
Yes.
So I'm very selective about when I decide to read things, just because my brain doesn't want to in a lot of instances. The other reason is I really do try to stay relatively uninformed about a lot of the game design stuff that other people are doing, because
sure,
there's that worry, and it's not even a problem if it happens, but there's that like osmosis that occurs that as you consume these other games, you start like those ideas start to percolate in your head, and then they manifest later on in something that I make. And then I go, is this something that I created, or is this something that I read in a book a while ago and I am now just sort of using somebody else's ideas? And there's nothing wrong with using other people's ideas. That's the whole reason SRDs and creator kits and all that stuff exist. And that stuff is awesome. I just have this weird thing where I want the idea to mostly have come from my head.
Yeah, sure. I think that's very natural.
It's a thing like, you know, I'm an academic. And so like a big part of academia is doing research that is novel and unique. And yes, you borrow from the research from previous people, but like you need to have like that thing that is yours, that thing that I know this and this is my line. And like, I think that part is like a part of the way that I design too. And so as a result, I have all these books, but I read the ones that are usually like written by my friends that is like, yeah, oh,
sure,
I want to read this because my very cool friend wrote a very cool game and I want to see what that game is all about. I don't ever do it as research.
Yeah, got it. Totally makes sense. Just kind of still thinking about how you are going about turning an idea into game. One of the things that I really enjoyed hearing you, I think it was from your blog, was the idea of leaving holes in your role-playing game. And I won't try to explain it. Instead, I will ask you, the person who blabbed it in the first place. First, just what does that mean? What does that mean for you?
Mm-hmm. Leaving holes in games to me means not having rules for everything. And honestly, not having rules for things that you might expect there to be rules for. There's a lot of reasons for this. One is if the game is full of rules, you're going to naturally get some people that just bounce off because they see the size of the book and they go, I don't want to do this. Two is the pace of play slows down. If you're always worrying about correctly mechanically resolving every single thing that comes in front of you, you're going to run into issues.
Mm-hmm.
Also, you as a table have infinitely more knowledge about how to best resolve and what you all are interested in at your table than I could ever know. And so I will give you the structure to play the game, but I will not tell you how to do every single thing because I trust you as human beings who know one another to govern the game better than I possibly could. I like more so the space of I'm going to give you the general structure and then you're going to inevitably run into something that is not going to be covered by the game. But whatever you end up deciding is probably better than what I would have tried to mechanically define ahead of time. And that's what leaving holes is.
Something that I think is a particularly interesting question for you in that your first game in a zine was nominated for an Emmy, you know, got nominated for awards and like got a lot of like essentially positive attention and feedback. Is there a point looking back where throughout the, again, like 15 games and supplements that you've put out that you say that's the game that not necessarily is the perfect distillation of me, but that's the game where things changed, you know, where it's like, oh, there was a before period in my game design, and then there's an after period in my game design.
Yeah.
Was there a moment or a project that you particularly kind of look back at in that regard?
There's sort of two that I think of. One is the game that I tell everybody that I'm like the proudest of, and I've sort of re-realized this, is Slayers. Slayers is the thing that I'm the proudest of, even though it was one of my earliest games, just because I think it does something so unique compared to so many other games out there that I think I captured something very cool with that, not only in terms of like mechanically how it's resolved, but also tackling something that's important to me, which is each of the classes in Slayers plays completely different from one another. It's very asymmetrical. It's from my love of board games like Root. That degree of flexibility in characters also allows flexibility in the sort of cognitive complexity of the characters, the classes. And one issue with playing any game, board game, video game, card game, role-playing game with a group of people is everybody needs to agree on the complexity of the game ahead of time that they are willing to play. And games are too complicated for some folks, and some games are too simple for folks and they bounce off. And so you have to find that Goldilocks game, and that's not easy. Mm-hmm. And so for me, with Slayers, you can play it with a group of people who have very different crunch preferences and still be playing the same game because there's a great degree of cognitive variance, like the cognitive load variance in that across the different classes. So that's like one of my big ones. The big turning point in terms of how I became who I am today, I think, was releasing Nova. Releasing Nova was like, okay, this is what I'm all about. This like encapsulates exactly what I think is cool and fun about games and what I want role-playing games to be about. It's definitely the like, this is the point where suddenly Spencer Campbell crystallized into like what he loves about role-playing games.
If I remember, was it Nova first and then Lumen? Like you kind of took it and then extrapolated an SRD from that?
They kind of happen at the same time. So Frame was first. Actually, Light was first. Light, which was my one-page version of Light in Destiny, was first. And then I started making supplemental stuff for that. And then the first full game before it became Lumen was Frame. And that was a whole thing. That was a whole disaster.
A whole thing.
In that whole project crashing and burning, I said, I will strip from the corpse of this game the core essences of what it was because I want to remake it in something else. And so in order to remake it into something else, I need to understand mechanically what this game was all about. And so Lumen emerges, and alongside Lumen is, and here's how I immediately start putting it to work by having Nova here as the thing that says, like, here's Lumen, and here's a very clear example of what it looks like.
I do want to, I think, just now kind of talk about the Lumenverse, the illuminated by Lumen. Just because I always find it so interesting when game designers decide to put out an SRD. And especially for you, you've iterated on this kind of base SRD a bunch of times now and done so many different things with it. And tons of people have worked with it. It would seem silly not to kind of explore what that looks like. So knowing that it predates it by a couple of projects and kind of evolved forward into the Lumen system, where did that idea, that kind of the core, here's the mechanic or here's the fantasy or whatever, how did that kind of start for you? And yeah, we'll go from there.
Yeah, I mean, it very much came from that scenario I described with my cousin of saying, like, okay, I can translate Destiny into a tabletop game that would be something that you would be interested in playing, as opposed to figuring out a way to make Destiny in 5e or some nightmare scenario like that. For me, I just had to think about, okay, well, what do I love about these games? There's a couple things. One is you are a very clearly defined class. You're a class or a character, like you have a role. Overwatch, you have a role. Diablo, you have that class. And in all of those things, you have a small suite of buttons that you push over and over and over again, which are your do cool shit buttons over and over and over again. And that's what I want you to be able to do, is I want you to feel really badass and cool by having things that you can basically at will do these very, very cool things. The concept of having like a basic attack is not interesting to me. The ability to choose between four very interesting powers is cool. And so that's like a big part of it was, okay, all these games that I seem to love have this sort of concept of a very specialized class with a suite of powers. So that's what it needs to be. And these suite of powers need to be like things that you can do over and over and over again. Another part of these games is they're very action oriented and like very much about the player driving the action and the game almost reacting to the player. And so that kind of manifests in Lumen with combat. Is usually, at least in the earliest Lumen games, is all the players go first in whatever order they want. And if anything is left standing, the GM then gets to react. And they get to take their turn, and they get to introduce weird twists, and they get to activate the enemies. And they also get to create the drops, which is like super video gamey, where literally just blobs of health or mana or ammo or whatever comes out of the enemies and you suck it up like a vacuum and regenerate your characters between rounds. That's what an encounter in Destiny is like. You run in and engage and fight. And then if there's anything left, then you'll start to be like, oh, okay, now I need to take cover because I didn't take everything out. There's some things still alive. And so now let me take cover. And then I'm going to take them out and I'm going to go get my shields back and I'm going to get my health back. And I have all my stuff on cooldown, reset, and I'm ready to take them out again. And so it was sort of those two concepts came together to become Lumen.
We've talked for like an hour without actually specifying literally any mechanics of the like, again, many games that you've made. Mostly because there's a lot, so why go too deep into it? But feels important for maybe the Lumen system. But yeah, so can you explain a little bit just how the game plays again, or at least how the system plays, knowing that there's a zillion iterations kind of therein for people who might be interested?
So the things you need to know about your characters are, is like we said, you have a class. So you have a very clear class or a role that is going to give you a suite of powers, usually like 3 to 4 powers. Those are things that you're going to use when combat shows up, at will, whenever you want, and they're going to do, you're always doing cool things when you're doing powers. Outside of combat, you don't have a big extensive list of stats or skills or anything like that. Again, the assumption is that you are like very capable characters. And so what is more interesting is how you approach solving problems rather than the skills that you have that are predefining what you can do in the first place. So they were originally called attributes in Lumen, and nowadays I call them approaches. So I kind of use them interchangeably. But the idea is, generally speaking, you're either doing things with force, powerful, emotional, things like that, flow, quickly, reactively, or focus, precise, methodical, things like that. And all of those things are, they have a number, and that's the number of D6 you roll. It's a simple D6 dice pool system. So you roll that number of dice and you choose the highest to see if you how successful you were. And that's how like original Lumen works. And so anything you're doing fits into one of those three approaches. So if you're trying to convince somebody to do something, if you are trying to like yell at them to do it, then you're going to use force. If you're trying to like line out the facts as to why they should help you, that's focus, right? It's not having a command skill or a negotiation skill. Yeah. You can do all of it. It's more how you approach things. And that just keeps things moving forward, is you're no longer going, oh, that's not a skill I have, so I'm not going to do it. Or I'm going to let the person who has that skill do the action. You can all do all the actions. It's just how you're approaching those actions determine the dice that you roll.
When I read that as a base, as like, this is essentially how the character imposes themselves on the world.
Yeah.
And, you know, like, is the driver of action. It just like absolutely unlocked something in my brain. It's like, oh, that makes like too much sense, like aggressively too much sense. This is just something that did occur to me that you already kind of mentioned that I'd love to hear you talk about, is some games are very much making sure that each of the role and each of their skills are very distinct. And, you know, Lumen does do that. Again, different suites of powers, different roles, that sort of thing. But when it comes to role-playing stuff, I think it would be easy to look at this, you know, kind of like generic approach way to handle social encounters and be like, well, but so now everyone can do anything. So is anyone special in those sorts of things? And I just kind of wanted to get, your thoughts on how that works in practice, I guess.
For me, like, the answer is like, yeah, everybody can do everything. And that's largely just because, like, I've played enough games where you have the person who's like the obvious social person or the face of the group. And so anytime you are negotiating, that player steps forward and does the thing, which is like cool. And they get their spotlight moment. But like, that just also means anytime a social situation rolls up, we know who we're going to send in to do the thing.
Yeah.
And like, it then just becomes very predictable. And you then would never try it because you're not as effective at it as the other person. And so you just wait until it's your turn to do the thing that you've been told you're good at, because that's what your character sheet says. As opposed to like, no, anybody could do anything. And you, how you approach it is going to be different, but you can do it. It's also like, if I were to get into the psychology weeds, it's like a manifestation of my hatred of learning styles. Learning styles is this thing that people are taught that you're an auditory learner or a visual learner.
Yeah.
And there's no research evidence to support this idea at all. And like, as a learning scientist, it drives me nuts to hear people do that, because it's devastating to kids. You say, you're good at this, you're not good at this. And so anytime they are presented something that's not that thing, they go, well, this isn't how I'm supposed to learn. I'm not good at this, so I won't learn this thing. And it's like a similar thing with characters, where it's like, you're good at this and you're not good at this, so wait your turn until like your style has shown up. And I hate that. And so I want people to just be like, I can do anything. And it's just more about how I'm trying to approach the thing, as opposed to I'm very skilled at this and I'm not skilled at this thing.
Yeah, that I love that. And we will be getting into the psychology weeds here in a moment. But I don't want to skim past Lumen too much, because, again, it is such a cool system. Something I wanted to talk to you about as well is that you turned it into a full SRD for it. You know, it wasn't just, here's this neat game. Feel free to iterate from it. And here's ways that you can kind of iterate from it. Is that you really went in and like, here's the SRD, or actually the creator kit, I suppose, technically, as it is labeled. What motivated you to turn it not just into a game, but into, hey, here's tools, here's kind of the design approach. And, you know, here's real in document tips, ideas. Go forth and make games and be merry.
Two things. One, spite. Because of the frame disaster, and having these weird ass gamers get really upset about Frame.
I think people said it was too close to Titanfall, if I remember right.
Warframe.
Yeah. Yes, excuse me. And then just you took it down from there, basically.
Yeah, I got harassed on every single platform you can imagine by the Warframe gamers who are upset that I made a love letter game about Warframe and like tattled to mommy and daddy at Digital Extremes about it. And so that was just this like weird, weird experience. And so I said, okay, well, cool. Here's what I'm going to do is I'm going to strip away all the rules of Frame and I'm going to turn them into something that you literally can't stop, which is an SRD that lets people make role-playing games based off of video games like your game. And there's literally nothing you can do to stop that. So a big part of it was spite.
Good. I mean, that is a spoiler alert, not exactly an uncommon response to literally anything on Reckless Talk that anyone has ever said.
Yeah.
That's like, I'd say at least 50% of episodes, the word spite has come up at least once.
Exactly. And then like the other two things were like, one is slightly self-serving is, okay, I knew that I wanted to recast this game and I needed the bones to build on. So like if I was going to make Nova, I needed the rules. And so it was purely like I need a foundation to build on because I don't want to just change the coat of paint of what Frame was. I want to be able to build something with the premises of how Frame worked, but in my own world. And then because my earliest time as a designer was in making hacks, and I think that's the case for a lot of people, is
definitely
hacking other people's games, making things for their own games, or making something off of an established system. I wanted to sort of give back in a like, yeah, that's how I did it. And maybe there's somebody out there who also wants to get started and wants to make a game like this. And I'm going to make this creator kit that is this sort of dialogue in terms of how it's written, in terms of here's how I think about game design. And here's why I think this game works the way that it does. And take as much of it as you want and make whatever cool things you want and just have fun with it.
A lot of people have made games based off of your games, whether it is the Lumen system or just kind of more generally of on this show, many people have been like, yeah, and I read Slayers by Spencer Campbell and that really just like inspired me to do my own thing. People genuinely name drop you as like, yes, I read the thing that Spencer made, or I read this blog post, or I blah, 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 blah. And I engaged with those ideas or the game and not out of spite, but out of inspiration, decided to make my own thing or again, make my own Illuminated by Lumen game or whatever. So you have made public things, and maybe we'll get into the bad parts about making public things as already alluded to, but like your games have inspired people and your work has inspired people and the things that you say and think and do have inspired people. Is that something that you can internalize and appreciate? Or I guess just what's your relationship, I guess, to that fact?
I'm incredibly appreciative. Anytime somebody either make something based off of what I've made or tells me that they got into design because of something that I did, it's the coolest thing that anybody could ever tell you. Like it's cool when people tell you that they played your game. That's a mind-blowing experience in the first place. But then it's a whole other thing when somebody says, I liked your thing so much that I made something for it. I made a Slayers class. Or I liked this idea so much that I made a game. That's like mind-blowing to me. That stuff is really, really cool. It's the stuff that fuels me in a lot of ways. I have a folder that has screenshots of like nice things that people have sent to me or said to me.
I tell everyone this. Our podcast has on our Discord a channel that is like screenshots exactly of being like, I really liked this episode, and just going back to scroll and be like, ah, that's nice when you're feeling down. It's, highly recommend.
It's super, super helpful because there are like plenty of days where I go like, why am I still doing this? Or is this any good? Or you're really struggling. And then you look at that and you go like, okay, I'm good at this, and or this is fun, and or other people are appreciating it. And so I've got that folder of some instances of like things that people have sent me or comments on like itch pages that are like really nice that mean a lot to me. Yeah, I mean, that stuff is, it's still like mind-blowing every single time. Like when I'm at a convention and somebody comes up and they're like, I love your game, it's so much fun, or oh, I made something for it. I just like, my brain still goes like, How is that possible?
Sure, of course.
What a wild idea to be like, you know, like people talk about like their design lineages, right? Like the family tree of like who inspired them and stuff like that. And somehow like I've ended up as a branch on somebody's tree, which is kind of a really wild, wild thing that I'm really appreciative of.
I mean, some of the games I remember when I was doing research have done crowdfunding. A lot of designers have played around with it. So it's a very real thing. And I'm glad that people tell you, because everyone should tell people when they're inspired by other people.
Yeah, that's super, super important to do.
It is just a quality,
yeah,
good thing. Before we talk about the topic du jour, which is your game coming out, I think it'll be out by the time this episode is out. But just speaking a little bit more about being a public creator of thoughts and ideas and content and the hustle that is inherent there. You do so many things, or have done so many things over the years, giving insight into your perspective, into your thoughts, into, you know, something that again, we barely have even scratched on, but your experience as a cognitive psychology researcher, and just about how all of this kind of fits in, and just putting it all out there for people to be like, hey, look at this. Here's a blog. Here's a video essay. What has inspired you to go that extra little bit further beyond, yep, I'm releasing games, you know, and I'm on Twitter and I'm blabbing about that, and people can read my thoughts in my games, and that's what I'm doing, all the way to like, no, I'm being very intentional and very transparent about your live streaming making games. Mm-hmm. Like, actively, there's your Google Doc on the screen. Anyone can just watch and hear you talk about it. So why is that something that you have done very consistently, it seems like, over the years of you doing this?
It's the academic in me, like, as a scientist. Like, it's all about exchanging information and making information freely available to improve the field. And so to me, the more information that's out there that is like easily accessible for people, the better, right? The better the scene will be overall. Like, I do my annual year in review streams, and I literally show you my financial numbers and things like that, because I think it's important for people to know what one example could be like. Not to say that it is the average experience or anything like that, but I just think like that level of transparency is super helpful to everybody. And then there's also, like, selfishly, I gain quite a bit from doing this stuff, like the design streams. There's like an accountability aspect to it of like, if I do that, like, I know that I will be productive for an hour, because I won't stream if I'm not going to get anything done. So I know that I'll hop on stream for an hour and something will happen as a result of that. I will move forward with some project, or some words will hit the page. And like, that's just valuable to me to have that thing that I can do. So that's like a big reason why I do a lot of the design stream stuff, is that I just know, like, okay, words will get written because I am doing this right now. But I just find that I gain a lot from putting my ideas down in these like videos or in blog posts and things like that. And I've been doing a lot more of that, or enjoying a lot more of that stuff, because I'm doing less social media stuff. I did like a blog post a long time ago about this concept of like one-way and two-way roads of online interaction, where like a one-way road is something kind of like this, where you and I are talking and we have this planned conversation, but there's nobody else involved. And like, whoever listens to this later on, they simply don't have access to me. Like, they don't have easy access to me. But if you're always on Twitter and posting on Twitter, people always have access to you, because they'll just be in your replies. They'll be in your comments on under everything. And that's very much a two-way road. The sort of assumption is that you are always open to conversation if you're posting on Twitter, or like having a Discord server. And now everybody can access you whenever you want, which is cool in some ways and then terrible in many other ways. But like a blog, I can post the blog, and even if there's a comment on it, I don't have to look at the comments. Like, I don't read most comments on things. And this is just a thing that I do, is like, I just genuinely don't engage with the feedback from most people on a lot of things, because it's usually unsolicited, and unsolicited feedback or advice is usually bad advice. And like, there are the people that I want those sort of thoughts from will send them to me, like the people that I trust and that I'm close to. And so for me, I have all these online things because I think it's valuable to other people, but also they are intentionally these sorts of things that I can send out into the world and then not engage with in any way, shape, or form. It's there. You can do whatever you want with it. I'm going to be over here now doing an entirely different thing. And this is not a conversation we're having. I am not doing this so that we can converse. I am doing this so that you know what my thoughts are, if you care about them at all. And you don't have to care about them. But if you do, here they are.
Yeah, exactly. And then it literally doesn't matter to me because I have said the thing I'm going to say. And then that's all. You take it from
there. Exactly. That's how I live. That's how I survive being online.
Again, before we really turn into your big project coming out, that's kind of the last thing I really wanted to touch on. I don't remember, it was a few months ago, you know, spoke a lot about kind of your relationship to that marketing, that social media, that access part of being a creator of content, capital C's implied on both parts, where we talked a lot about just like, it was burning you out. It was bumming you out. All the various outs that could be had, it was doing to you, it seemed like. And so we try hard here on the show to really explore the human part of the people doing and making the things. So I guess, could you just talk a little bit about that decision ultimately to start to rein in where you're present and where you're turning your energy, especially as it relates to being online and marketing, as opposed to just creating fun little games that you like to make?
That's the thing. Like, that's the big struggle, is what I would like to be is the person who sits in a cave all day long and is not around anybody. And then I make a thing and I emerge from the cave and everybody goes, wow, here's the thing. The next thing from Spencer Campbell. Cool. And then I go, goodbye, everybody. I'll be back with the next thing.
Enjoy.
That's the dream, of course. And that takes a lot of time and a lot of people being dedicated fans to you before that sort of thing can happen. But there's plenty of designers who have hit that point. Like, I think about somebody like John Harper. John Harper is not aggressively online all the time like all the rest of us. John has established himself as a very adept designer who can disappear and then just be like, and here's Blades in the Dark and here's Aegon. Enjoy it.
Yep. You're going to love it. Carry on.
Goodbye. I'm going off again to my cave in Seattle to live a happy, peaceful life.
Yes.
That's the dream, but that's hard to get to. And you have to do a lot of stuff to reach that point. And not everybody wants to reach that point, but as somebody who's put a lot of serious consideration into what if this was just my job? What if this was what I did? How can I make this thing that I really, truly enjoy more than anything in life, designing games? How can I make that the thing that I survive off of while also maintaining my sanity? Which is something we have to ask ourselves about all the other things we do. And so I ask it about this as well. And being hyper engaged on Twitter was just not doing it for me because everybody's just angry on Twitter all the time. And there's just nonsense discourse. And I'm guilty of it too. I posted nonsense and we all do it. And so it's just what have I gained from all of that? Nothing. I've gained nothing. And usually whenever I get attention from some sort of discourse post, I hate having that attention. So it's why did I do it in the first place? And I'm on my second iteration of my Discord server right now. I had a previous Discord server and I destroyed it because it got so big and it was filled with random people that I didn't know who were talking about shit that just bothered me. And I said, okay, bye. This is over. And then I opened up a new one. And I had the plans of keeping it small and just with designers. And then I foolishly said, well, I'm just going to open it up to anybody who likes Gila RPG stuff. And I haven't nuked the server, but I don't engage with it anymore. I made a post in the server that said, hey, folks, I'm not in a good space with online interactions. So you all can stay here, but I'm not going to be here.
Yeah.
And so it's just about figuring out the things that you can and can't handle. I can't just disappear off of social media because I'm not the cave person yet.
May we all one day
we strive, find our own caves. We yearn for the cave. And
yeah.
I would love to be there, but like I still need to like post incessantly about loot and other things like that when they get released or when they're coming, because I need people to know about that.
Yeah.
And so I have not looked at my timeline or feed or whatever it's called on Twitter since October of last year. So I'm approaching a year of not looking at the feed, which is a really good feeling.
I was going to say, how's your brain feeling after a near 12-month detox?
It's good, but the other thing is it's bad at the same time because there's an extreme loneliness that comes from this. I've made so many friends and connections through these sorts of platforms that if I'm not regularly checking in with them, like I am with Will, then I have no idea what most of them are doing. I have no sense that they are releasing a new game until I see it on Itch. And I go, oh, shit, this is here now. I didn't know that. That's cool. There is a disconnect from what is going on, and like disconnect primarily from my friends and the people that I feel close to in the community. So there's pros and cons to that.
Yeah,
of like,
definitely.
Yes, I feel good because I'm not putting poison in my eyes every single day. But also like I'm now.
It was tasty poison.
It was tasty poison. And like at least we were drinking it together.
Yeah.
And like now it is like I'm desperately trying to get in the cave, and the cave is a lonely place, but it's also a peaceful place. And so it's a weird balance that you have to strike.
We were also on the like a year, like we were 2021 when we started and a lot of other people were too.
Yeah.
And like this space being a very important like social outlet for a lot of people and making those very real connections.
Yeah.
And now 3 or 4 years later, everyone being like, man, I'm burnt out. That place got way shittier. Mm-hmm. I don't know what to do with it is I think a very real thing. And I again, that's one of the reasons that I thought it was so wonderful that you really talked about kind of the impact of it. In an effort to be one more like stepping stone on the path to your cave, let us talk about loot just a little bit, because, man, there's so many interesting bits about loot. A, just because like, hooray, looter shooters, like, yay, give me more shiny toys to play with. But there's so many bits and pieces just from the little bit of reading that I did of it, of there's a lot of parts of your prior games, it seems like to me, at least as an outsider, that have kind of all coalesced into, again, shiny new thing. So from the beginning, where did loot come from? And where did the steamroller first start up that has become this game?
So the concept of loot is driven by this mechanic in it that is the loot pool, which is sort of a deck of cards of items that will change over the course of your campaign as you add items for whoever you're working for. You work for Thieves Guild, they're going to add daggers and cloaks to your loot pool. You work for the Mages Guild, they're going to add spells and robes to your loot pool. You know, that's what a looter shooter is. A looter shooter is about choosing the activities that are going to get you the items that you particularly are seeking out. And I thought, okay, how can we bring that to a role-playing game? How can we do that sort of like you kill the boss and random loot is going to come raining down on you, but it's not completely random. There is some control to it because you have you intentionally chosen this mission or this thing, which increases the odds that you get that item you're looking for. And I had been thinking about like where to put this thing for years. It was originally going to be in light, which makes sense. Light is destiny. And so, put it in light. But I sort of made the decision to stop making stuff for light just because it is so obviously destiny that like, I don't want to keep making stuff for it, not out of fear of gamers, but like, it's just more fun going back to our previous conversations of making stuff that are like that are the worlds that are of my own making. And so if I were to make stuff for light, it still feels like, yeah, but you're just kind of making more destiny stuff. So I never ended up releasing it because I was like, I don't want to make more destiny stuff. And so eventually I kind of figured out that this could work in another genre entirely. And I just needed to think about what genre would fit. And I had recently worked on Rune, which is a solo game that I made that's inspired by Souls-like games. And your character is made up of cards that have your weapons and various things that you have. And so, like, I was seeing this sort of, like, paper doll character emerging in Rune and going, like, okay, like, what if, like, all of you was the paper doll? Like, your health and your stats and everything was coming from the stuff you were wearing. What would that look like? And how would you support that? And that's where I then started to say, ah, that loot pool thing works here, where you are now a blank canvas of a character. You're some adventurer in some fantasy world. But you are going to be swapping on and off magic items and clothing and swords and whatever until you find the build that you like. And then you go, okay, but I want to go like do some work for the Thieves Guild because I want a new shiny poison dagger or something like that. So let's go work for them and get that into the loot pool so that we have a chance of getting it. And so it really was just me trying to take a concept of one of my favorite things about looter shooters and waiting until I had found the space for it to fit without the most obvious space, which is light.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Something that I noticed and appreciated about a lot of your games and certainly is maybe the most distilled or at least particularly distilled in loot is your kind of eschewing of normal or at least like classic D&D class progression systems where it's like, yes, you are a barbarian. That means you go on an adventure and then you get these fun tools. And then you go on an adventure, a couple more adventures, and you get these fun tools. And boom, now you get to choose which couple tools you get. And the way you're describing it and the way I've read loot is very much not that. It is very much like it's all driven by player choice and it's all driven by a little bit of random chance, but also some intentionality and some other things. So is that something that you have specifically tried to sidestep kind of throughout your design process and with loot? And I guess why has that been a recurring theme, I guess, for you?
It's something that I wanted to try with loot just because I feel like with some of my games, there are like, you know, in Nova, you pick a spark and you get a very clear set of powers and like you have a role. You can still do everything with the approaches like the Lumen Tech, but like you still have like a very clear role. And then I wanted it in like loot to be okay, but what if you didn't have a clear role? Like, or yeah, what if you wanted to change your role? And that doesn't involve re-rolling an entire new character, but like you just wanted to do different things. That could be a pain when you have a system that's entirely defined by classes or, you know, predefined archetypes and things like that. And so loot really was, okay, what do you want to wear? What do you want to carry around on you? Because that's the stuff that is going to manifest your various abilities and powers and literally the stats that you have. So you could be the person who's got the giant two-handed axe, but also like the thin wizard robe that you're wearing at the same time, because the axe lets you do something in combat that you really wanted, but the wizard robe gives you a power in exploration that you're like, oh, I really want to be able to talk to squirrels, so I'm going to wear this robe, but I need to be able to fight things, and so I want the big, giant axe as a result.
Yeah. So loot does a big scope of things just in terms of Lumen, just kind of as an example, is again, the mechanics are there to go fight stuff and to get, you know, kind of replenished by fighting and generate new powers and loot and items and that kind of stuff. But otherwise is like very focused and very to a point. Loot is still kind of serving that same singular. You go out, you explore, you come back with your loot and you do stuff. But there's a lot more mechanic, it seems like, there to kind of support this more robust ecosystem, I guess, that you've done. Was that, again, something that you, from the outset, were interested in exploring? Or is that just kind of a natural consequence of like, ooh, okay, if I want people to go out into dungeons, I guess I need to figure out a way for them to go explore dungeons. Or, oh, hey, I had this game over here sitting around, I'll just use my own game and put it in this new game. There we go.
For me, I love like a very clearly defined gameplay loop. Yeah. Like I just love that in games, even in my role-playing games. Like I've had great fun in the wild sandbox where you just are exploring, but I just truly love, here's the loop. And if you do this loop over and over again, you will get a very satisfying hit of dopamine as each step is, you're checking the box of each step. And so for me, I knew we need to get to that point where the players are getting random loot rained onto them. And we need that to happen regularly. That can't be something that is like, at the end of five sessions, after we finish this long journey, you finally get your loot. It's no, every session you need to get loot. And so you must design these quests that you're going on to be single session experiences.
Yeah.
So that you have time to go back to town, see the loot pool get updated, get the loot dealt out to people, and also then like sell the unwanted stuff and build up the services in town and things like that. And so like there's
like town building as part of it, which was so surprising as like, again, having read a lot of your other games that are very like, nope, this is what it is. And this, oh, you're also building a town. Mm-hmm. And that's very different and very cool.
Yeah. Like base building mechanics can be fun and but they can also be a drag if it's like, you need to go collect these various different kinds of resources in the world. Sure. And I was like, well, we're not doing that. There's one resource and it's loot. There's no gold. There's no anything like that. Yep. So it truly is, you're going to get a ton of loot handed to you. And like most looter shooters, you're not going to use most of it. You're going to go, oh, that's kind of a cool piece. I'll hold on to this, but no, I don't want this thing. And does anybody in the party want this? No. Okay, cool. Let's sell it down for slag, essentially. And
yep.
Our party has a collective gold pile, but it's just like big nebulous wealth, essentially. And you use that to build up the town. And so you can turn individual advancement, which is what the loot is, you individually are getting better, into party-wide advancement. Because now we have all collectively sold enough loot that we can buy this thing. And now this exists in the town and we all benefit from this. And so there's always some sense of progression. Even if you're not getting mm-hmm. a brand new set of loot that you're going to use all that stuff, that you're always getting better in some way, party or individual.
To me, it seemed like it scratched all the itches that you want from like a Dungeons and Dragons, where it's like, yeah, you're going out, you're questing, you're getting cool stuff that reflects the experiences you've had. And you have meaningful ways to like turn that into direct role playing and resources and town building stuff. So I'm really excited to see how it all plays out. But I have a small wind up to my next loot based question, which is one of the things that I look back at when I first kind of heard about you, was kind of introduced to the Spencer Campbell of onlineness, I guess, and the games and stuff that you did. It was shortly before, and therefore I got to enjoy the spectacle of you just starting to like throw out what at the time seemed like bonkers ideas for tabletop role-playing games when it comes to combat, where you're just like, I remember, I think the first post was like, you know, I don't think you should have to roll to hit playing combat right. ever. And then eventually it progressed to like, you know what? Dice. I don't think we need them. And that being so like hilariously, like, not actually revolutionary in some right. ways, but so drastically revolutionary in many other ways, which is the case in loot, is that you've got, there are no dice. There are no dice in loot. Mm-hmm. You have pools, you have other fun things, but in terms of random generation, dice are nowhere to be found. There is a 6x6 grid, I think, for yep. combat, and cards that have cool weapons on them. And is that it? That's close
That's
to it.
That's it. I That's think. All you need. You can have fun, punchy, tactical combat without having any rolling involved at all.
Can you just talk a little bit, certainly in the context of loot and the fantasy that you were kind of trying to achieve there, but just generally about how you have started trying to eschew such peasant concerns like dice rolling and whatnot?
Yeah. So, I mean, I generally think that, like, we don't need dice to tell good stories. Like I've alluded to before, like, I just don't think most social and non-combat stuff need dice in the first place. And I also don't think you need it for combat either. But like, I think we can tell cool stories and have conflict and friction just in cool conversations with each other. But if you want to gamify it a little bit, I think resource management is infinitely more interesting than randomness, managing randomness. And so in diceless Lumen games, it's not that your characters can do anything and anytime that they want. They have those same approaches that we talked about before, but rather than that number being the number of six-sided dice you roll, It is the number of times you can do something with that approach before you are unable to do it any further. And it's actually not even that you can't do it any further. It's that you can do it. There will be consequences as a result.
Yeah, right.
And like, that's the thing about rolling is we're always rolling and waiting for that roll that is success with a consequence so that something interesting happens. That doesn't happen in the beginning of most diceless games because your characters are fresh. They're good. They're going to be fine at doing most things, but eventually they start to get tired. Their minds are going to slow. Their bodies are going to ache. And when that happens, they cannot so easily do whatever it is that they want to do. And they have to then start making decisions, how to creatively make use of the resources that are still on their sheet. And when are the times that they will push themselves and do something knowing a consequence is coming their way? And other times they will eschew the action going like, I don't have it in me to do this right now. Somebody else has to do it. And, or we got to figure out another way to make this happen other than the major consequence that I'm going to get for like pushing my body past the limit. So that's where like the diceless component comes from like a non-combat perspective. And then at that point, even in Nova, one of my older Lumen games, you're not rolling in combat. You have, like I said, the do cool shit buttons, like in Diablo. You're not rolling dice. Yep. You're just pushing the button that lets you do the cool thing over and over again. And it happens. And it feels so good to make that happen. And so in Nova, your characters just do the powers. They happen. And it's because it's a power fantasy game and it feels good. And loot isn't a power fantasy, but instead has that sort of resource management. You have weapons that have like base things that they can do no matter what. There's no rolling. They have ranges and damage that they deal and effects and things like that. And then many of them have a charged ability, which is like a cooler thing that they can do. But when you do that, you essentially have to tap the card like in Magic. And now that weapon can't be used as a charged weapon anymore. You can only do the basic until you decide you're going to spend your turn recovering and getting all those things untapped. And so it's a resource management game. It's managing when to use your cool powers. When can I go Super Saiyan here? And when do I need to like recover and catch my breath and let my other teammates like kind of cover me while I'm doing that? And I've played so many tactics games in my life that don't overtly involve rolling or randomness to them, that there's enough evidence out there that you can have really compelling skirmishes without needing any kind of randomness to determine success in that.
Out of respect of how much time I've already taken, I have a single question remaining.
Okay.
And it is maybe an unfair question to boil it down to a single question. But one of the great heartbreaks that I have of this conversation is not also doing a 3-hour conversation about cognitive psychology and how it plays into your games. Luckily, you've done a good number of videos on the subject on your channel, which will be linked through YouTube on the episode description. Please go check it out. But you have a great psychology of TTRPG. You're kind of almost like lecture series that I think you put out a little while ago, but it's still a lovely time and very interesting. And I think a lot of people can learn stuff from it. As GMs, as players, as designers. For you, is there something from kind of your day job of cognitive psychology as a researcher, educator, etc., that you have noticed is like core to your either your like your design process or just like worldview on games and tabletop and that sort of thing that might be either certainly true for you, hopefully, but also something that might be valuable for other people to kind of take away with your robust experience, both in psychology and in making games?
I think the thing that is probably most like apparent or like kind of runs through a lot of stuff that I do is the stuff that I talk about in terms of problem solving. And there are two types of problems in terms of how we define them in psychology: well-defined and ill-defined. A well-defined problem has a clear outcome, clear goal, and clear rules that you're allowed to follow to get to it. A Sudoku puzzle is a perfect example of this.
Mm-hmm.
There's no interpretation to a Sudoku. You don't get to like add in extra boxes or be like, no, nope. In this one, I'm going to let there be 2 7s. That's not how it works. And then there's ill-defined problems, where either the goal is unclear, but the rules by which you're allowed to play are clear, or the rules are unclear, but the goal is clear, or some nightmare combination where both of them are unclear.
where neither are clear at the same time. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And the best sort of thing that you as a GM can do is to use both of these things in the stuff that you do. Well-defined problems are great because they have a clear, obvious path that the players can follow, and there is a sense of progression that happens. When you do the thing, you know you will be rewarded for doing the thing because this is the right way to do it. That feels good. That creates a sense of satisfaction. But ill-defined things are infinitely more fun in some ways, and especially when you think about combat, which is why, like, I released a game where there's no health for enemies, because if enemies have health, the obvious rule is bring them to zero health, and how you do that is by dealing damage to them with weapons and spells that do various amounts of damage. It's a well-defined problem. But an ill-defined problem is one where enemies die in one hit, but some of them have weird things you must have accomplished before you can take them out in one hit. They have an arcane spell protecting them, and there's some totem in the room that needs to be destroyed in order to do it. Or they've got super durable plate, and all your mundane weapons bounce off of it. You need to figure out how to get past that plate. And there's no overt rule that says this is the piercing weapon that gets through heavy plate or anything like that. You as players have to think creatively about how you would make that happen. And that then encourages the core mechanic of Lumen, which is you can do anything. These approaches allow you to do anything. How do you want to do it? And the ill-defined problems are the problems that really let people do that stuff. And so I just encourage people to just make more of their things ill-defined. And I mean, this is not like revolutionary idea, because like you can even look at like how like concepts of the OSR are like this, where like sometimes the puzzle is like you just put a puzzle in a room and you don't know how to solve it, but you just watch the players like talk it out and they're like, yeah, this is how I would solve it, and you go like, yep, and you did it, you found the solution, because I didn't know what the solution was. Like, that's a core tenet that like exists in a lot of games, but we understand it from a psychological perspective as sort of these well and ill-defined problems, and that there are typical strategies that we expect people to use in those as well. And so there are ways that you can kind of encourage or discourage certain behavior with how you design scenarios.
I think that's super, super wise. And I think the perfect thing to end on, because it's so inspirational and so good. And unfortunately, now we have to go into the very confrontational, the very, I would say, the kind of like emotional, spiritual end of the interview, because unfortunately, despite the good times we shared, despite your wisdom and the joyful conversation that we've had, and you know, kind of all the things that I know, ways that I have grown as a person throughout this conversation.
I'm so nervous right now.
It is time for the Reckless to Talk lightning round.
Okay,
I think you've already signed all the legal waivers that kind of go into this leading in, but we still have to kind of out loud confirm that we have given you all the details of this, frankly, harrowing experience.
I think I'm ready.
That's what they all say, unfortunately. So
mentally, I might not be, but like
for both you, our lawyers, and anyone who might be new to the show, the lightning round is the same. We ask the same questions to every guest in the same order every single time. There are no wrong answers. You can go on as long as you want. You can say something as brief as you would like. You can say, you know, I don't really have a good answer for that. The only wrong answer, I guess, is like lying is kind of the only thing I tell people, just because it's like lame, I guess. But it is all fair game. It can be single word answers. It can be whatever. It can be nonsense, a non-answer to the word, whatever kind of speaks to you and your soul as a human is the correct answer. And I will pause respectfully to ensure that you are done answering. I will nod sagely, which will not translate to our podcast listeners. And then I'll ask you the next question. And there will be, much like loot, a reward at the end.
Oh, okay. All right, I'm ready. now that I know that there's something at the end.
incentives, baby.
Mm-hmm.
Now you have to survive to the end.
Yeah, okay.
First question. Is your glass half full or half empty?
Half empty.
What excites you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
Genuinely, I mean, it's video games. My whole career is built on video games.
And I have no follow-up questions, such as the format. What does not excite you creatively, spiritually, and or emotionally?
Doesn't inspire me? Marketing. Marketing doesn't inspire me.
What is your favorite sound?
My wife singing.
What sound do you hate?
My dog crying.
What is your favorite word?
Rasp.
What is your least favorite word?
Synergy.
One that has been said before.
Really?
Just in case that is of comfort to you. What tabletop role-playing game, monster, antagonist, archetype, etc., have you never faced or run that you would love to?
I've never faced, like, or I've never run or faced, like, an actual dragon.
Not unpopular. There's a lot of people who have not run dragons. So
cool.
Put a dragon in your games, people, please. Just do yourself the favor. It doesn't matter what genre it is. It can be a cyberpunk dragon. Just do it. What is your favorite adventure of all time? And this again can be a tabletop adventure. It can be one you wrote, one you read, one you watched. It can be 1999's The Mummy. Whatever favorite adventure means to you.
Favorite adventure that we ever ran was in that Star Wars campaign, my very first one. And it was the finale where they had to break into the Jedi Temple. And I don't even know why they did it, but they pretended to be vault inspectors. And it was just a series of hilarious calamities that ended in literally Snake Eyes ending the campaign. And it was perfect.
What is your favorite tabletop role-playing game character of all time? Again, similarly, it can be one of yours, one you played with, a famous one, one you read in a book, whatever that means to you.
Yeah, I don't really get to play, so it would be one of my players. I think probably my favorite character that a player played was Al, or Alcinda Day. I think that we never called her by her full name. We just called her Al, but she was in our like first big long fantasy game, and she shows up in some of my other games, like stuff that I've published for careful readers.
God, awesome. Everyone, start looking out. Spencer, final question.
Okay.
Of the gauntlet that you have gone through.
Okay.
What gives you hope?
Oh, my wife. Easily. Easily my wife.
Spencer, with that, I would like to extend my congratulations, a hearty digital handshake,
All right.
a clap on the back, what have you, for having gotten through not just the Reckless Attack gauntlet that is the lightning round, but also Reckless Attack itself. Thank you so much. As your reward, as promised, because, you know, this interview, all about satisfying gameplay loops, is please tell everyone once more who you are, who you have been, how they can support you, where they can find you, all that good stuff.
Nice. I'm Spencer Campbell. I publish tabletop role-playing games under the name Gila RPGs, G-I-L-A RPGs. You can find me online with that handle on pretty much everything. If you go to gilarpgs.com, that links to like my itch page, my Shopify page, my YouTube channel, my Twitch channel, all that good stuff can be found there. And yeah, I truly, like any social media, you just search Gila RPGs and that's where I'm going to be. So that's who I am. And that's what I'm up to.
And as always, that will all be in the show notes. Please go check it out. Spencer, thank you so very, very much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Bye.